Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my friends, and welcome back to the pod, albeit in a slightly different form and at a different day of the week. As I mentioned on Friday's episode, this is a special bonus episode of Catch Up, which Cassie Delaney has christened Sit Down with Louise McSharry, which I like. And the idea is it's a much longer episode and it's a chat with... Well, today it's two people, but it could be one person. And essentially, you know, at the core, I think of most of the work that I've done over the last 10 or 15 years is a belief that shared experience is the most powerful thing that we have as human beings. You know, so little of what we go through is entirely unique, and we can learn so much from hearing about other people's experiences, and also that moment of recognition that happens when you hear someone talking about something that you've experienced is just so powerful and so healing and can really make people feel less alone and more supported. So I love to try and give people the opportunity to share their stories when they want to. And I was absolutely delighted when my two guests today asked me if I would be up for chatting with them on this podcast. And I was so enthusiastic about it because Katie Richardson and Amy White, formerly Hamilton, they were Hamilton when I first knew them, are two sisters who just have been on an incredible journey together of health and surrogacy. And the reason that they were so passionate about speaking to me and sharing their story is that, you know, surrogacy is not really being dealt with well in this country at the moment. And there is a conversation happening about legislation. And they thought that maybe if people heard a real firsthand account of what it's like to, I suppose, make the choice to have a baby by surrogacy and then to actually go through the process, people might have a greater understanding, which is exactly what I'm talking about. So anyway, I won't wish her on anymore. I hope you like it. What I will say is this was the first time that I've had two guests on the podcast. This week I did two interviews with two guests, and I discovered that one of my microphone cables did not work. So the sound is not as good as I would like it to be, because the girls had to share a microphone. But I think, you know, if you can kind of get over that, you'll get used to it. It's not too bad. And the reality is we were sitting around a table in Amy's kitchen, and I think that's just what it sounds like. So I hope you enjoy. Now you can really have some nice, close sister time. Okay, so I feel like it's important from the get-go for me to say that we know each other, but we don't know each other.
Yeah.
We were all in school together. Amy, you and I were in the same year in school. Katie, I was saying, like, to me, you're eternally 16, because that's
me too.
That's how old you were when I last kind of knew you. But, you know, we're not super close. And I have only known about what's been going on in your lives over the last few years because of social media, really. So, which is good, really, because that means that for everyone who's listening, you know, they don't know the insides either. Mm-hmm. So let's start at the very beginning, because you guys are here to talk about surrogacy and your experience of surrogacy. And where did that journey start for you guys?
Am I going to go?
Yes, you are, yeah. So in 2008, when I was 25, I was diagnosed with cervical cancer. So through my treatment, it ended in a hysterectomy, Which was just the best way to remove all my cancer. Mm. So I suppose at the age of 25, I knew that I couldn't carry my own children. Mm. My oncologist was amazing though, so I was able to keep my ovaries. So I still have my ovaries. So that meant that I had the option of genetic link to a family, and I didn't have to do IVF at the time of my diagnosis.
How did you feel at that time? Like, I think a lot of people at 25 maybe would still be figuring out, do I want kids? Do I not want kids? But how was it for you?
The funny thing is, like, I feel like I've always wanted kids and a big enough family, because I suppose there's four siblings, or there's four kids in my family. Like, I've got three siblings. And then later meeting my husband, who is one of six. Mm. Like, we're always around each other. So I knew I always wanted a family. But I think when I was diagnosed at the time, I was just like, get the cancer out. And yeah. I didn't hesitate on anything. And I was just like, I just like to get this cancer out and me to move on. So I knew that a family was a thing I wanted, but I guess I didn't comprehend at all at the time what lay ahead. Mm. I know my parents massively did, but my other siblings weren't having families yet. So mm. I think we were all, as a team of siblings, probably not too fussed over that part. We were definitely more worried that, like, to make sure I stayed alive.
But mum and dad
were like devastated for the fact that their kid had cancer, mm. and then that their kid was going to have a different journey to having children.
Mm. What do you remember of that time, Katie? Because how old were you? You were even younger.
Yeah, so I was about 20 at the time. It was a huge shock. The idea, Amy seemed so healthy and well and was just getting on with life. And I remember Amy and I going to the cinema. I was going away with my friends in university for the summer. And Amy and I went to the cinema beforehand. I don't know if you remember this. Mm. And she had just told me that she'd noticed signs and symptoms and she was going to go to the doctor. But it was all taking very long, the process of figuring it out. So it was in the back of my mind, but I never imagined that she was going to end up having cancer.
Mm.
And then it was very much save Amy's life. There was no kind of thought of family in that for me anyway. But I do remember mum and dad being just devastated at the idea that Amy might not be able to have kids. And I think also science wasn't there yet. You know, science has come a long way in the last 5-10 years. So at that stage, even IVF and things weren't really talked about anyway. No, even if they were done, they weren't really talked about.
Yeah. Because how long we're talking, this is about 14 years ago.
So like, it was a whole like family, like different dynamics of families was not really that much of a thing, or if it was, it was very much, you know,
quiet.
Yeah. And really hush. Like, people didn't talk about miscarriages. Yeah. Forget about any other family journeys.
Or adoption.
Or even same-sex marriages. None of that stuff was happening. We've changed a lot in 14 years.
I think you're absolutely right. And obviously, because I had cancer too, I can relate to that feeling of, you really only are focusing on one thing, aren't you? Like, and it's just literally, let's just get through this. And you're not really thinking that far down the line. Or I certainly wasn't. And it sounds like you weren't either. It was mostly just, let's get past this cancer hurdle, which is understandable. It's a pretty big hurdle.
And I think to add to that, you know, our dad also had cancer and went through that journey too. And from friends, I think I haven't had cancer, luckily. But for you guys, actually the hardest part seems to be the post-cancer. You know, coming to terms with life after cancer is very challenging, I think, for people.
Yeah, I think it really can be. I still feel like I'm processing, and it's been 7 years. Like, I think I was very, when I was in it, I was very focused on, I'm going to be fine. I'm going to do my chemo. I'm going to be fine.
Yeah.
And then I was fine. And I remember when I got the all clear, I felt nothing. Like, I'm nothing. And I was like, this is this moment I've been waiting for. And I should be feeling fireworks going off. And I felt nothing. And I'm still 7 years later processing. You're kind of smiling.
I had a friend over for dinner tonight who also had cervical cancer. And we were chatting about it. And I was just saying, like, before I had cancer, I was a great partier and I would be able to go out on lots of nights and really become free in myself and like just let loose and, you know, get in the zone. But like, since my cancer diagnosis, like, I don't particularly like big crowds, and no matter how much I drink, I'm always very sober. I'm never able to release and be free in that same way. And she was saying the exact same, like, just like, there's a shift, and I can't explain it. I guess you possibly have some kind of understanding of her, but for anyone who hasn't, like, you never let loose in the same way. Like, I just physically can't be, I suppose, and as wild as free as I was before.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, I wouldn't choose to be the life and soul of a party anymore. In a sense. Yeah. I don't know. I can't describe it.
No, I get it. That makes me think two things. First of all, it makes me feel really sad because, like, what a shame that you had to have that shift in your personality. You know, it's so unfair. The randomness of illness, I think, for me, was one of the things that I'm not being very articulate. I remember when I was sick, I went and saw The Theory of Everything. You know, the film about Stephen Hawking, and it's about him at college and when he becomes unwell. Yeah. And when he finds out about his condition, and I had like a full breakdown in the cinema, like I just absolutely lost it. And I was like, what is going on with me? And I realized it was, once your eyes are open to the fact that overnight your life can change, illness is so random. You can just wake up, you can be doing everything right, you can be super healthy, you can be, you know, running marathons or whatever your barometer for health is.
Yeah.
And still, you can get very seriously and suddenly sick. And that feeling, that awareness, I think has a real impact and can have a real impact on the way that you live and the way you feel about everything.
No, you're so, like, that's such a good description of it. I guess, yeah, like, you just, you know, I would have probably lived before being like, yay, I'm, you know, you're just going to get old and you know, things are going to pan out the way you expect. And I suppose that's probably what the change is that you just kind of like, nothing is set in stone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You actually have no control.
No, yeah. No. Yeah. Like, you have certain things you can control, but then those kind of diagnoses, I don't think you can control.
No.
Even though people seem to think that maybe there's a certain hand you can play in them, but there's also definitely a huge hand you can't.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I totally get that. So, at what stage, then, did you start thinking about the fertility aspect of all of this?
Not for a long time, I suppose, because I was in 25, like, not many of my friends were at that kind of family age. And then when my siblings started to have kids, I suppose it became more of an awareness and a conversation. And I know that, like, then as people started to have families, everyone would always, you could tell, they'd always be a bit kind of like, oh, and, you know, for you, and which I get, it's probably not the easiest person to say I'm pregnant to, and or I accidentally got pregnant. We weren't planning this. I suppose, like, with any partners I had, like, I had a long-term boyfriend before my husband, and it was from the get-go a conversation of, like, me and a family is going to look very different. So I had gone down the route of, was adoption an option for me? But Ireland, it's actually a really tricky journey as well, unfortunately. Yeah. And it's actually really expensive.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised. I was quite surprised about that part. It's a very long journey. And then when I started going out with my husband, he obviously really wanted a family and would, like, was really great with kids. So he really wanted to have kids and was kind of, like, excited about a genetic link as an option. And it is amazing that I have the option of a genetic link. So
can you explain a little bit about what that means for someone who doesn't know anything about this stuff?
Yeah. So I still have my ovaries.
Yeah.
Which meant that I continued with my normal hormones as if I hadn't had a hysterectomy.
Right.
So because I had a hysterectomy, I have a monthly cycle, but I wouldn't bleed.
Okay.
So I still, like, go a bit crazy and I still get some spots and my boobs would swell and all those kind of things. But it's harder to tell when it is because obviously you don't bleed. So it's a...
Oh, that would be so tough. Like, every month or every 6 weeks or whenever my period decides to come, I have a few days of, like, am I going crazy? Am I losing my mind? And then I go, oh no, it's my period.
Well, and there is that part that I have to sometimes sit back and be like, that is why I am going through this emotional, slightly sporadic emotions. but I don't miss not having my period. It's kind of like that part's okay.
The only bonus, really.
It is, yeah. So so because then each month I obviously create eggs like anyone else. So when we got to a stage in our relationship as to what we wanted to move on family-wise, because obviously I can't carry my own child, we just were like, let's get on with using my eggs as young as possible. Yeah. So we did my IVF in 2019.
And how long had you guys been together at that stage?
Timelines. After we got married, we got married about 2 years, and then just after that, we decided we'd start the IVF because everything was going into a freezer, you know? So you might as well do it when your egg reserve is younger.
Sure, yeah.
Which is, you know, it took a while to kind of get to that stage of, you know, that's actually what we're going to do. And you need to obviously have a plan as to what you're going to do with them as well. So I suppose that's when you come in, Katie.
Yeah, Katie, can I ask you, Amy mentioned there, you know, that it was when you guys, when her siblings started to have kids, that obviously, you know, this became a real thing that needed to be kind of confronted or talked about or whatever. And she mentioned that she probably wasn't the easiest person to tell that you were pregnant to. What was that like?
I think it was pretty tricky for our families. And our oldest sister, Jilly, was the first to have kids. But she suffered from really severe hyperemesis during her pregnancies.
Right.
So her pregnancies were very difficult. And that was always complicated as well, because I guess Jilly had always thought maybe she could be a surrogate, but she just was so sick and they were worse with every pregnancy. And then I had a really big journey with endometriosis. Mm-hmm. So I was a stage when I thought, well, there's actually no way that I could ever be a surrogate. You know, I was told I was going to need my own IVF.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2015, I fell pregnant. Out in New Zealand, which was a bit of a surprise for all of our family.
I love that expression, fell pregnant.
Yeah.
I tripped.
And now I'm pregnant.
And I was living in New Zealand as well. So it was quite a big deal. And I remember, I think I was sitting in the laundry room in my current house trying to pluck up the courage to ring Amy and tell her, because it's so hard to tell somebody who struggles with fertility that you're pregnant, but also that you're pregnant and you are coming to terms with that being a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's that other side of the coin where
always straightforward.
No, and it wasn't straightforward. I mean, I was living in New Zealand and I wasn't married.
Yeah.
God forbid.
I mean, shocking.
Shocking.
I am shocked.
Totally. Yeah. So that was a big, big part too. But I think in reflection, and Amy and I sometimes talk about this, that it happened for a reason.
Yeah.
Because if I hadn't started to have my kids so early, I wouldn't have been able to do this for Amy.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I'm 34 and I have a family of three, which is pretty young for modern day, you know? And also, it was then that I realized what Amy was missing.
Right.
So, and I often think about this. I remember going into my son's room when he was, must have been about 6 months old, and looking at him in the cot, and although it was probably the 20th time I'd gone in and I was absolutely exhausted, that kind of deep love that you have for your kids that you can't really describe, I knew that Amy wasn't necessarily going to have that. And that was when I first went, okay, maybe I could do this.
It's a huge thing to consider, though. I mean, can you tell me about those early thoughts?
Absolutely, yeah. And I remember, like, the funny thing is I vividly remember walking down with the beach with a friend after giving birth to Cooper and going, I could never do that for someone else.
Right.
Because birth is so crazy.
Yeah.
And that alone is one of the things that I have to keep thinking about. Like, it's all well and good to be pregnant for somebody else, all well and good to give a baby to somebody else, but actually giving birth, I've my labors haven't been easy, and they're not easy for anyone really, are they? But the actual giving birth part, I think, is the hardest part for me. So that was one of my thoughts, like, could I do this for somebody else? And then I had to really work out, was I going to say it to my husband? Was I going to be like, how would you feel about having a baby for somebody else? But interestingly enough, when I did sort of pluck up the courage to say it to him, he just went, yeah, totally, if that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
He got it. And then it kind of started from there. But when we went to decided to talk to Amy and Reggie about it.
Yeah.
We were very much on the page of, this is something what we'd like to be able to do for you, but we don't know whether we will be able to do it for you. So let's open the conversation and let's see what it would mean.
Yeah.
So that's, been a huge part of it.
And Amy, tell me about your side of that. I mean, had you hoped or thought or, you know, where were you kind of in your line of thinking? And then how did it feel when Katie came to you and said, look, we want to give this a try?
Well, when Katie came to say it to us, like quite a few of my friends had kids.
Yeah.
Because I'm now nearly 40. Do you know what I mean? So,
Can I just say, how are we nearly 40, Amy?
I feel like we were sitting on the floor of school. I can remember you sitting on the floor of school. Do you know what this memory is? You were debating whether, I think it was where you lived. It was like, is it Churchtown? Is it Rathgar? And you were like, I don't know. Like, some people say it's Churchtown, but I think it's Rathgar.
Oh, the memories.
Yeah, I don't feel like it's like obviously more than 20 years since
But it doesn't feel like just, that long ago. It's wild.
The fast, slow part of life.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. So we are nearly 40.
Yeah, so as in this conversation was like 5 years ago, I guess, probably. So a lot of my friends were having kids and getting married and stuff. Myself and Reggie really kind of were like, we would like to, he would really like to have had a genetic link. And I had been down the road of looking at adoption before, and I knew it was like, it's about a 7-year process from the start for adoption. So like, if you don't start early, by the time you get to that stage,
you're too old.
Yeah, you're too old. Exactly.
I've interviewed people before about this. I interviewed an amazing foster parent who ended up being a foster parent because that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
The adoption process took so long that by the time it was kind of all the ducks were in a row, they were deemed to be too old to adopt.
And then am I also correct in thinking that if you are going down the adoption process, you can't be going down the fertility process as well? Not frowned upon.
It doesn't help your application, and actually probably really goes against your application. So we had had the conversation of, would we adopt? And then, with that, we had the option of a genetic link anyway. Yeah. And in a sense, we didn't really have fertility concerns. We just needed to get them out of me. You know what I mean? So when we were going through IVF, we weren't, I suppose, going into it so much going, I wonder, will we be able to create embryos? Yes. It was kind of like, let's just make embryos.
Yes.
So that was definitely a help, because I know a lot of people who have gone through a surrogacy process have been through all of the different emotions of all the... So, we kind of, in a sense, skipped that part to get to the surrogacy part. So, I suppose in the healing part, it was slightly different.
Yeah.
So when Katie and Blake brought us out for brunch one day and said it to us, like, just out of the blue, like, there's no way to describe. Like, first of all, I was actually quite shocked. Like, I we had in our head been like, I wonder, could a sibling do it for us? And, we had thought of all the female siblings and we'd kind of gone, no, Ginny Mac, no, just, oh, they couldn't. Seeing them with their own kids and how busy they are, and also knowing that birth is pretty bonkers. So we didn't expect it. And we were just blown away with even the idea that it was a conversation. Because it is the biggest gift. Even to be able to create that conversation. And I know I've had some people who throw in the, oh, I'd carry a baby for you. And you're like, well, please don't throw that out there unless you actually really have thought it through. Because it's really... Like, I've found that part of my surrogacy journey quite difficult, that people would throw it out there.
Yeah.
But when
my counselor said that to me recently, she said, it's so good that you do, they've done the counseling before you go through the discussion about surrogacy, because I'm telling, before we spoke to Amy, that we would have had counseling and stuff. Because she was like, most people that end up in this situation have had a bottle of wine, tell the person they're going to have a baby for them, and they're like, oh no, I didn't mean that. How do I go back on it? Whereas Blake and I were very prepared up to that point, that we were sure we were offering it for the right reasons, as opposed to, oh, we'll have a baby for you.
Yeah.
And I think it is hurtful when people say that. They're, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And then they sober up and they realize they won't.
Not a flippant.
Oh, but people do say flippantly.
I believe
which
it.
Which is wild.
I'd believe it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, So you had this conversation about let's give it a go, and then was it complicated from there, or was it like what were the next steps?
Is it complicated? It,
well, I suppose that's what, at that stage we hadn't done our IVF,
right?
So that kind of pushed us then to do our IVF, and I suppose, like, again, this is a few years ago, and IVF is constantly changing and evolving. Yes. It's, even from year to year, it's amazing the difference. So when we went to start our IVF journey, when we went to our clinic, they were like, well, what are you going to do with the embryo? And I was like, oh, my sister is going to carry a baby for us. And they were like, you can't do that here. And we were like, oh, no, she said she'd like to do it, so we can. And they, in fairness, were very much clear cut as to, well, we can't put that embryo in her. So we can freeze it for you, but there's really not an option for you to do anything here with it. And because Katie lives in New Zealand with her family, we were kind of like, oh, we'll make this work, you know. Yeah. And we were so determined, and I guess a bit naive, which is probably good in a sense.
Yeah.
Like,
we were so naive that we turned up at different fertility centres around Ireland being like, can you, like, we're knocking the door. Yeah. We won't take a no.
And I guess we also rocked up to a few different fertility clinics to kind of beg them to do it, you know? Because I know that, like, with the lack of legislation in Ireland around surrogacy at the moment, technically no clinic will put it in to somebody. They can, but they can't, you know? Yeah.
They can't get ethical approval for it.
Right.
But I do know it's happened, and in some clinics do transfers.
Yeah.
But any clinic that we went to, and no matter how hard we tried, we're like, we're not going to, which I understand, because they don't want to be in a vulnerable situation.
Yeah.
So we were sitting there with, us all set with these embryos and Katie wanting to do a transfer. It. And no one in Ireland would do a transfer. We looked at, we chatted to the UK as well. And again, it wasn't really an option as well. So, like, I started and I did my IVF, but because I'm missing a lot of my body parts from all my surgeries, my IVF was also quite tricky because... Yeah. Like, you couldn't do a vaginal retrieval to
access the
eggs. So each time I ended up with 3 rounds of IVF, I had to go in for surgery and do laparoscopies to do it.
And that was so tricky because they had to be able to do laparoscopies in a hospital setting, but also get the embryo straight to a fertility clinic.
Yeah.
So there's actually no there's no fertility clinic in the country that actually can do that kind of surgery and do their fertility. I know, like it only gets more complicated. I suppose this is where we were naive.
This country and women's health, like, it's actually sick.
Yeah,
like, why is there no joined up thinking? Like, all of this stuff should be happening in the same place. Like, it's crazy.
So for me, we came across the most wonderful fertility and women's health surgeon who managed to do my surgery in one hospital, bring all of the fertility equipment across the car park into the hospital to do this surgery on me. Correct my eggs, bring them across the car park to get my husband's sperm to put them in and try and make embryos. But like the fact that like everything had to travel, all the team, all the equipment had to go across the car park for me to do it. And I ended up doing 3 rounds of it.
Yeah.
To create the embryos that we needed. Like, and I was the only person in the country who had done it. Like, no one else. Like, he had made up this option because he knew how much I wanted to have a family and that I actually had a surrogate.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't have done it if I didn't have a surrogate and it wasn't my sister.
Ready, yeah.
He was like, I wouldn't do it because it's like, it's such tricky surgery and we don't have the structure in our healthcare and women's health to do it. Like, so amazingly, we did create embryos. And they went across the car park to the fertility clinic.
And then, am I right in thinking they went to New Zealand?
Uh-huh. Well, I'd have to say that Amy's talking about it very pragmatically.
Yeah.
But for Amy and Reggie, every time we sat in the clinic and they said no, it was like someone
breaking your heart a little bit more.
Well, I think also because we had all the pieces of the puzzle. Like we had embryos suddenly. We had a surrogate who was a family member, so as safe an option as you can have with the legislation in Ireland. Do you know what I mean? And we were all set, and we had done a huge amount of work to get there.
Of course you
and
had. We'd even done counselling off our own back. Like we'd been seeing the fertility counsellor together
in our combination.
You had done all of your work.
Yeah.
And then you were being let down by an ill-equipped system.
But just the fact that no one could do the transfer for us. So Katie at the time was living in Ireland because my dad was so sick. So she was home to be around him.
So you had that then in the background as well. Not only are you going through this stress, you have the situation with your dad,
and we really wanted, like, a dad wrote a bucket list, which we found recently, and one of the things on dad's bucket list was get Amy a baby. It was actually the first thing on his list.
Yeah.
So,
and it was literally get Amy a baby, because
I really enjoyed that terminology.
But more so, he was like, how do we get her a baby? Because the fact it takes. And the fact that it was so complicated, like even when I like reflect on all that we've been through to date, and we still have much further to go on our journey, like chatting to like my parents, who my mum's in her late 60s and my dad was his late 60s at the time, and explained to them what we were doing, and they were totally on board, and my husband's mum in her 70s was on board, my granny was in her 90s
and she was
like, this is a great idea, because everyone was so like, you know, you have all the bits, why can't we make it work? And we just got really stuck not being able to do the transfer.
You would have really liked to have been able to go home and tell your dad that this was happening.
Absolutely. And we told him as much as we could. You know, we kept it all very private for many reasons. But, you know, dad knew
that it was going to happen. Because that he wouldn't, like, he couldn't have left without knowing that. Yeah. And also Katie was pregnant with her second at the time as well.
God, yeah.
Okay, so you were, meanwhile, Katie's pumping out the babies.
Yeah, pumping them out. Yeah, so I was, and because that's one of the things I suggest, is that you don't be a surrogate until you've finished your family.
Right.
Which didn't actually happen in the end. But anyway, that is one of the things they suggest. You know, you need to have had kids to be a surrogate. And I 100% agree with that.
Yeah.
You could not do this journey if you hadn't experienced pregnancy and birth and know what you're getting yourself in for. Which is a reason why legislation is so important.
Yeah.
Because New Zealand, ethically, you have to meet all these standards. And that's one of them, that you're, A, have had babies, and B, close to finish your family.
Yeah.
So we were at that point where we couldn't do it in Ireland. Couldn't do it in the UK. Looked to Barcelona, looked everywhere, and knew it was going to get too hard. So I can't even remember how New Zealand came about, but most likely because I was living there.
Yeah, well, it was because you were living there, but also like it's so like anyone who's on a surrogacy journey, it's the last option you choose, you know? You don't go, oh, this is great fun, let's just try that one. Because it's such a long journey. And also, it's so complicated. It's financially, no matter what, no matter who you're dealing with, it's expensive as well.
Yeah.
Because there is IVF and of sorts, no matter what type of family situation. But there's no information out there. There's no guide.
Yeah, there's no website that says, this is how it works in New Zealand. This is how it works in...
And as we chatted to a few more people, like... people come out of the woodwork, but a lot of people would have gone to North America for it.
Yeah.
Which they're like, they have great systems there and it's, it is really expensive.
Yeah.
So North America just kind of wasn't an option, and it's a bit further away. So the fact that Katie was living in such a forward-thinking country where family can be so many different things, and spending time in New Zealand, you really realize family is whatever you make as your family, and I think that's amazing. And we haven't really come to that yet in Ireland.
Yeah, we've got a bit of work to do.
Like it's amazing seeing all the different family dynamics and how a granny actually can be a mother.
Yeah,
and that because there's that missing link, and they step into that role, and that's everyone in society is okay, on board with that. And well done you for looking after that little child.
Yeah, and it has to be said, there are lots of grandparents, and I was raised by my aunt and uncle, and there are lots of those families in Ireland. I just don't think they're as well supported.
Yeah,
or talked about.
Yeah.
So when we,
when we kind of were on our journey, I suppose there wasn't as much chat about it. And now where I am on my family and surrogacy journey, I now am part of a WhatsApp group of 200 people who wow. are going through surrogacy, and it's an amazing support tool for each other, just for even little random questions you
yeah,
can ask.
Yeah, that would have been amazing for you, I'm sure, like, yeah.
Would have been amazing 5 years yeah. ago, but it wasn't there.
Yeah.
So when we ended up, Katie's family at the time wanted and needed to move back to New Zealand, I just find the culture over there just so interesting, and like even the fact that there's a conversation that can be had around surrogacy and yeah. like it is legislated, and there is like we had so many boxes to tick, which was a lot of work, but I totally see why we did it.
Yeah.
Like we had to have counseling of me and Katie, and then of the husbands, and then the four of us, and to check that everyone was actually on ready board, for what yeah. it was. And we had to, you know, all of the
medical where checks, legal like, checks.
And where your where the both sides of the embryo, like the egg and sperm, were coming from, and were they in an ethical way, and you know
yeah.
all the important things that need to be checked, and everything
so
was
you
checked.
Had to make sure that all your I's were dotted, your T's were crossed, everything, all your ducks were in a row. And then was it kind of go time?
Yeah, well, I had to organize a courier, so like it's really interesting the courier part. Like actually a very nice guy that Google IVF careers or fertility careers or wow. you know, all these weird things that you're like, where do I do that? So anyway, I found this career company who we've used many times now, and he's super nice. And I remember at one stage he was like, we were nearly at the end part of the Korean part, and he's like, if you'd known it was this complicated, would you have done, like, I was like, honestly, I'm so glad I didn't know how complicated it was. Because even to get to courier your embryos from one country to other, you have to get a lot of paperwork signed off as well, yeah. which can take a few months.
Wow.
Oh my God. Which again, I'm
tired just listening to this. It's amazing the work that you did.
The project is incredible. Because the question is, you know, if embryos arrive in a different country, what citizen are they? Who are they?
Yeah.
You know, like it's so complicated.
The things you just don't think of.
Yeah.
You know?
And the legal side of it. We were so fortunate because I think that was one of the first steps in New Zealand, was someone recommended this amazing lawyer to us.
Yeah.
And she just like she would jump through hoops for anyone, so yeah. she was determined to make it happen, and so much so that even later on in the process, when all our documents were in the ethics boards, you know, somebody made the comment, if she wasn't behind you, this probably wouldn't have happened.
Yeah,
because she had to kind of vouch and say, legally I can make this work.
Yeah,
yeah.
So she's been just wonderful.
Wow.
Yeah.
God, it's so much. And like, so this at this stage, how long has the process been going on?
I think it was about 4 years from when we said to Amy and Reg we would do it to when we actually did a transfer.
Okay. Yeah.
And that wasn't for lack of trying.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, no. Yeah.
That was just
yeah.
process and
red tape. Yeah. yeah.
And also I think the part is like, it's not just that you're learning like this whole new process and this huge project, but it's so emotional as well. Like it's, you know, like for me, my sister and her husband are creating this offer to yeah. do this for us, and you know there's so many things, and we had told my family, and we kind of mentioned it to Reg's family, we didn't tell our friends though and stuff, because we didn't even know it was going to happen, like, and
yeah,
so everything is confusing and emotional, and you're trying, and then as you're going through those 4 years, your friends are popping out babies left, right and center.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because like, you know, I find it hard to like ask someone for a lift, so like I can only imagine the complexities around someone offering to do this amazing thing for you, and it then becoming so complicated. Like I just can't even imagine the complexities of the feelings.
I was going to say that for me, you know, every hurdle was emotionally very hard for Amy and Reg, but because it wasn't that emotionally hard for me, it was easier for me to push on.
Yeah.
So had Amy and Reggie had a surrogate who wasn't related to them, maybe they wouldn't have had the drive to keep pushing to figure out what yeah. was next. But I wasn't emotionally attached. So I was like, well, I'll just email this person.
Right.
And whereas I think Amy and Reggie were over the constant rejection and the constant too hard basket, but I could yeah. just keep plodding along. Mm. And I think that was made a difference to how we got there in the end.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Because there was times when it just seemed too hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So you did get it approved. Thankfully, you had the backing of this amazing lawyer, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And then you had the career. So off your little embryo went. How did that feel? Even just sending it off?
I don't know. I suppose it was all such a blur. It was kind of like just getting that step closer, but you still just don't know what's going to happen.
But and they'll pull out on the way, or, you know, like, it's so much.
And there's, like, this one amazing person picks up that embryo from your clinic and brings it door to door, and it's them on a flight, which is your embryo. It's, like, the fact that there's things being going through the airports all the time that you don't notice in canisters full of nitro is just, like, amazing. So it arrived there, and then it was kind of time for us to do a transfer.
And then it all became very straightforward.
Yeah.
You know, then it was like, okay, well, you've got ethical approval, we've got your embryos, here's your date. And then it kind of became my journey then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I really got an understanding of what people go through for IVF.
Yeah.
You know, and I know Amy had done the physical side of the surgeries and stuff, but that emotional side of just even the simple things like, okay, your bloods are at this today and your bloods are at that today and you've got to drop everything this morning and go in for blood tests. And, you know, that was all quite complicated.
Yeah.
And it really, I really began to understand what people go through. I also was getting... As part of the clinic, I had counselling on hand, which was great. And later on the journey, I really pulled on that. But that was always in the background, which was really good because, you know, it is such a complicated journey. Yeah. And then I also actually connected someone who lived more local to me for that extra little bit of support.
Yeah.
And I used it all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when the transfer happened, was that straightforward?
Yeah. Yes. So I was really lucky because... Despite having endometriosis and people saying, like, once you have endometriosis, that's it, you're infertile. Yeah. It's not true.
Yeah.
So I was actually able to do it on a natural cycle, so I didn't have to have as much of the hormonal load.
Okay, great.
So we tried that for the first transfer. And so myself and my husband went in and, you know, took some photos for Amy and Reggie of us going into the clinic to have their baby. You know, it's so weird when you think of it like that.
Yeah.
And it is amazing, the transfer process, and, you know,
popped it in
and off we went. You know, I would say I knew I was pregnant almost immediately.
Really?
Yeah. But then my own pregnancies, I had very clear signs that I was pregnant.
Okay.
But I didn't say that to Amy and Reggie because I would have hated to...
Get it wrong.
Yeah. And I was also very fortunate that I've never had a miscarriage, you know. So I was aware that this was my third pregnancy. So there was a chance, you know, I'd had two straightforward enough. So there was a chance that I couldn't miscarry.
You never know with any pregnancy.
You never know. And, you know, the rates are so high.
Yeah.
And someone else's genetics as well.
Yeah.
It's not your own genetics. There's definitely something there too.
Yeah. But you were pregnant.
I was pregnant, yeah. And it's one of the things that kept me going through the journey was the thought of things like telling Amy and Reggie I was pregnant and all those big milestones. But actually, when you're going through something that big, the emotions you expected to have, kind of like what you said when you got the all clear from your cancer, they're not really there.
Yeah.
You know, like, if there's so much pressure on this moment of ringing Amy and Reggie and being like, you're having a baby, that you're kind of actually just a bit flat or something.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know if you guys felt the same, like there was such huge anticipation on that moment, and me sitting at home with my two kids waiting for the phone to ring with the clinic to say that I was pregnant was huge. Yeah.
So at what stage did you decide to make that call? I mean, how, I presume you guys had an agreement.
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of, because obviously, like, you know.
There are different timelines. It's the middle of the night too for Amy and Reggie.
Yeah.
So they were lying in bed knowing that I was expecting a call, and the agreement was that I would get the call so that I could prepare myself and to tell them. And especially if it wasn't a pregnancy, it would have been easier to have that.
So. Yes.
I waited for that call, found out I was pregnant, and then called them. Which makes it sound much more normal than it was.
And we did wait.
Sorry, Amy, can I get you to just...
Sorry.
No.
And we waited for, like, the initial, whatever, is it
it's all different numbers when it's an embryo as well, because the embryo is already nearly, by the time we do the implantation, it's nearly 4 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because of the cycle time. So it's actually a much shorter pregnancy in a sense.
Yeah.
Didn't feel
well,
much.
I was just going to say, Katie doesn't.
I know, but like your weeks kind of
suddenly, you're suddenly at 4 weeks, the nearly the day they do the implantation.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Like yeah,
So your 12 weeks is nearly at 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Mm. So,
I don't know how many weeks I was. It must have been like 5 weeks or something when they did the blood
test. Yeah.
But then mum came out for that Christmas, which was amazing. So the implantation was in November.
Mm-hmm.
Mum came out for that Christmas. So mum actually got to come to, I think it was the 10-week scan, I think.
Yeah, 12-week scan.
Two scans, actually, mum got to come to.
And
I brought my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law was fantastic. Like, she was amazing. Just so supportive to us all. So she actually came to two of the scans. And then, so I was lying on the table, you know, and they're doing an internal scan, and mum and my husband's mum are both there taking photos and videos to send home to Amy and
Reggie. There really is, like, there's no dignity in any pregnancy, but like, I mean, really, I can imagine when you're sharing a pregnancy with someone else and it's ostensibly two people's pregnancy, it's totally. Even more complicated.
Yeah, like, you never really think your brother-in-law is going to be there to watch you give birth.
No.
Amy, can I ask, tell me about your end of that phone call.
Like, I guess when we were waiting and you're waiting and the time, and then they're in the clinic and you're like, their appointment was now, they haven't rung. And like, you've such hope, and again, I guess such naive hope that it's just going to go well because it's been so complicated. So, you know, she was like, we're pregnant. We were like, of course you're pregnant. We transferred an embryo. Like, what do you know? So I guess like, we didn't really feel like it wouldn't work because so much work had gone to this.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And and then when she sprung to her, like, oh, that's great. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I knew the embryo was in there.
So you, for you and Reggie, Amy, it was, we did the work. Of course you're pregnant.
Yeah.
But then you have to start planning for your baby. And am I right in thinking that this was all happening like toward the end of 2019?
Yeah. So Katie, like Christmas Day, we were like maybe 10 and a half weeks or something, I think. Mm. So we told Reg's family.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really special.
Which,
for me to watch those videos. Is
really and even special. To watch it back, it was actually just, that was nearly one of the more exciting parts, being able to tell them, because they were fully supportive of it, but we had kept them not as in the loop, just because that was just the way Reggie felt. He's a good news person, so he likes to give good news, not bad news. So he's willing to give them good news, and we video telling them. And Florence is one of she's 23 cousins.
Wow.
So there's so many kids, and everyone has like kids.
Yeah.
So everyone was so excited, obviously, that for us to become a family. So that was just amazing.
Well, you were a family already, but to add to your family.
Yeah, but I suppose for us to be parents, so obviously we 100% were a family, but to have that different role as a family.
Yeah.
So that was just, you know, like for them, knowing what Katie was doing and the journey that Katie and Blake were on and the kids, because like it is, like, obviously it was Katie's pregnancy, but I think people forget how much of an undertaking it is for the surrogate's partner the kids as well. Like, and I feel like, you know, it's not, someone said the other day, oh, you three are amazing. And it's actually four. You know, Blake was taking on a wife who had morning sickness and was really emotional and all the rest. For not his own child.
Yeah.
And not even a child he was going to raise either. Yeah. So, that was just huge. And then when we got to the 12-week stage, you have to tell people. So we started to tell people. And I know that everyone was hoping and knowing that this was something that we were trying to do. You know, like that we really wanted to have a family. And people were obviously terrified to ask how.
Yeah.
Because I've always been so open with my medical history and stuff, which I have found for me has been important to share.
Yeah.
So that was just such an exciting part to kind of be like, this is going to happen. And because Florence is one of the youngest of the grandkids as well, people were just like, amazing, we're going to empty our attics and drop everything over to your house. Here you go.
I do do love getting rid of stuff, I have to say.
Yeah. Which has been amazing, but it was just, yeah, it's been... So yeah, like that was, I suppose, for us, again, possibly naively as well, being like, she's pregnant, child's pregnant, of course we're going to get a baby at the end of it. Mm. Which has, like, I suppose now that I'm a parent, I understand that I was quite naive in that journey.
Mm.
But amazing that we are parents now. So yeah, I guess... It was around, we were due to go for the 20-week scan, which was a big thing for us because we hadn't seen Katie pregnant. We had sent this embryo over and we weren't able to help. Mum was over helping for a bit and then Mum came back. And we had some scan pictures, but that was kind of it. So we were booked to go over for a 20-week scan and for 2 weeks holidays. And then we were going to come back and then go over a few weeks before the birth to be there.
Yeah.
And we kind of had a vague plan because, you know, you kind of can plan
and
stuff.
And I would say we were all very naive in that plan.
Yeah, it was a really naive plan, but sure, like, again.
I was like, oh, what weeks will you come over? Oh, maybe 37 weeks, you know. Yeah.
Which it feels a little close.
Yeah. But, you know, that's kind of where we were at.
Yeah. Very. Meanwhile, for you, Katie, I gather it wasn't an easy pregnancy.
No, it wasn't an easy pregnancy. It wasn't an easy pregnancy for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
I think... The genetics of the pregnancy, it was the sickest I've been with any of my kids, morning sickness wise.
Mm.
I had two young kids myself. I was trying to work and I was trying to just get on with life.
Yeah.
And if I was to do it, go back and do it again, I'd cut something out because it was just too much going on.
But also, can I ask, because one thing that I think is important to acknowledge is that you're carrying a baby. And when you're pregnant with your own child, you know, I certainly found that I was trying to kind of bond, even though it didn't actually come that easily for me, certainly my first pregnancy. You're trying to connect to the baby while you're growing the baby. But it was a different thing for you because it wasn't your baby, but it was your niece.
It was totally
different.
How did
you manage that?
Yeah, it was like one foot in front of the other every day. Yeah. And it was a... I had to consciously not bond with the baby. So that was probably part of the practicality of like, I'll just keep working and I'll just keep on going because I had to just keep moving forward and not overthink it. And I wonder, was my sickness a part of that picture, you know? But I was also quite anxious in the pregnancy. Mm. And I have come to realize because I had my own third child after Florence, and they're Irish twins. So I was anxious in that pregnancy too. So I think that for me is just a part of pregnancy. It's the hormones, and
it's actually quite common, isn't it?
It's totally common, and I think we don't talk about it. You know, like I find life harder when I'm pregnant.
Yeah,
and that's, you know, emotionally I find it harder. But I also found, people's attitude towards me hard.
Yeah.
Although they were saying things like, oh, you know, this is an amazing thing to do and wonderful and like complimenting me on it, the attention wasn't what I was doing it for.
Mm.
So I was a bit overwhelmed with every time I went out, people asking me questions and, you know, wanting to tell me how amazing they thought it was. And meanwhile, I was just in my head being like, I feel so nauseous and I just want to get through this.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get through.
Get through this. So, and people meant really well, but I found that very difficult myself.
Yeah.
So at about 14 weeks, I was still sick. I was sick until about 19 weeks. And I called the counsellor in the fertility clinic and I was just sort of said, I need help.
Yeah.
And from there, she sort of spoke to me every week, pretty much every 2 weeks, and became a huge part of my journey.
Mm.
A friend for life. Mm-hmm. And she really helped me to find my way through it. But she also said, you know, that it's very common with surrogates to find the mental health side of it very challenging.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me at all.
I mean, pregnancy is
so
hard enough as it is.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, everything that we had planned changed. So Amy and Reggie were planning coming out for that 20-week scan. And then there was a epidemic.
Yeah, a pandemic.
And then suddenly that turned into a pandemic,
you
know. And all of a sudden... They were talking about closing the borders in New Zealand.
Mm.
So we rang Amy and Reggie and we're like, we don't know what's going to happen. This is what they're saying in the news. I think you need to get here.
Yeah.
And thank God they did, because if they hadn't had come into New Zealand when they did, the borders closed a week later.
Yeah.
And they probably wouldn't have gotten in. Like, some of the stories of people being blocked out of New Zealand were pretty horrific. So I think if it hadn't worked out the way it had, I probably would have had to fly out to Ireland to give birth.
Yeah.
So
if
they
even could.
Yeah, so like, Amy and Reg had about 24 hours notice before they packed up.
Yeah, we literally, after that call, like, literally jumped on a flight to, like, 24 hours later, and we, like, packed really lightly because we're like, oh, let's go for 2 weeks. And then I was like, Katie thinks, like, bring some baby stuff. And I was like, oh, it's like dramatic, but sure, let's keep her happy. So, like, you have to laugh. So all this stuff was piling up in my house, and I was like, okay, I'll just take some baby grows because that's all a child needs. So
In the immediate aftermath.
I didn't even bring vests. Like, so I
didn't think they were even newborn sizes.
They weren't, so I packed 0 to 3 months
yeah.
in my bag just to keep her quiet. So we got there, I'd be like, show her the baby grows, she'd be cool. Like, and then when I got there with these 0 to 3 months, she was like, where are the newborns? And I was like, it's 0 to 3. And she was like, newborn's a different size. And I was like, what?
It says 0. They come out at 0. No. Oh, man. Like, I remember all of that, though, with my first pregnancy. Like, I didn't have a clue. I remember a friend of mine gave me a list, and she was like, this is what you should bring to the hospital, and vests were on it. I was like, vests?
Totally. Ooh,
that's a thing? Yeah. I mean, you don't know.
No. I remember texting my sisters and being like, do I need to bring socks to the hospital for a baby? Like, do babies wear socks?
Well, they do, but they never keep them on.
It's... Yeah.
So you're going for a couple of weeks, bring a few bits, keep Katie quiet. Yeah.
Like, my other sister was a bit panicked. She was like, I think it's pretty serious. I was like, oh,
you didn't even empty your fruit bowl.
No, like, there was, like, literally, we were going for 2 weeks, and there was, like, even washing on. I was like, maybe someone might just come in and take the washing out of the washing machine. Like, little did we know that we'd be there 6 months.
Yeah.
Like, so, and when we had, like, dropped our dog last minute over to a friend and was like, do you mind minding our dog? We'll be back in 2 weeks. And she was like, no problem. And then, like, okay, it's getting a bit longer. So we arrived, and 2 days later, the borders closed, and we, like, yeah. And then we also arrived into a sudden rule that day that we had to isolate for 2 weeks. Right. So we arrived for our 2 weeks holiday to isolate for 2 weeks.
Right.
And but not see Katie.
Amy and Reggie arrived. We couldn't even hug them. You know,
so freaked out.
It was so weird emotionally on all sides, because I was pregnant with their baby and I had a little bump, but they couldn't even hug me.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we were staying really far away from
it. You know, it was like, wave at them from a distance, drop them some food. And, you know, the beginning of the pandemic, we didn't even know where it was going, you know?
No.
Yeah.
Again, maybe thankfully we didn't know that.
No, I know.
In a sense.
I was in total denial about, I was like, 3 months? What?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
How could this possibly last 3 months? Little did we know.
Mm. So, yeah, we were there thinking, you know, maybe we'd do our 2 weeks of isolation, and then we'll do a week and we'll see a scan and head on home. But obviously that all changed. But, like, for the best, like, because...
Absolutely for the best.
It was amazing to be there and to help out. And because Katie's kids were... Two and four at the time. Like,
okay, yeah.
So we could hang out with them as well. And also they're my niece and nephew. So it was just so much fun to spend time with them. And
the relationship they have with Amy and Reggie now is so special.
Yeah.
You know?
And also they knew that they were having, like, they were having a baby for us as well.
Yeah.
So it was really nice to get to know them before they were going to give us this baby that was in their mom's tummy. You know, that was our baby, but in there. So, like, all of those things were... amazing.
Plus we needed the help.
Yeah.
And with Reggie being a chef, my freezer was just full of all these amazing meals. And, you know, we really needed the help. And I think Blake and I naively had kind of thought, it'd be fine, they'll come out at 36 weeks and then we'll give them a baby and they'll go home. But actually we needed them to be there. We needed the help.
Yeah.
And as a team, you know, as a team of four adults, we needed all of us to be there.
Yeah. And then it was 36 weeks then when it happened, right? Which... Yeah. If you'd been coming at 37 weeks.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, so 36 weeks, actually my mother-in-law took the kids for a few nights and I was like, great, I'm just going to go to bed.
Yeah.
Went to bed, had a really good sleep, got up, putting my essential oil, it was like a birth cam essential oil, into my diffuser. The house was silent and my waters just went. So I think I rang my midwife first before I rang Amy and Reggie, and her use of words wasn't so polite. when she picked up the phone.
And so I then rang Amy and Reggie and was like, surprise! And I think Reggie's reaction was, I'm not ready yet.
Yeah, and I was like, great, our baby's coming now. Like, I was so excited. I was like, we'll get the baby soon. This is fantastic. But I know, like, our midwife, who was a huge part of our journey as well, was like, it's not ideal for it to come early. And we were like, but what? It's a baby and it's clearly ready. Yeah, so we were... I was really excited. Reggie wasn't prepared at all in his mind, but as like, how can you prepare?
Yeah, you can't, but, really.
So we went into the hospital that night, and I was sort of like leaking waters, and they in the hospital, they were like, oh, you know, maybe you've just wet yourself. I was like, look, this is my third rodeo.
Yeah.
I know that it's not. So there was a bit of kind of hemming and hawing because I wasn't going into labor.
Yeah.
So then they did a few tests. I stayed the night and they confirmed that it was my waters. And then I was luckily enough that my husband's parents have a place close to the hospital. Mm. So we were allowed to stay there and then come and go for day appointments. Otherwise I would have been admitted and it wouldn't have been that much fun. So I would come every day, they'd just check me and make sure I was fine. My midwife was in touch with me all the time and they kept me then till 37 weeks.
Okay.
So that was like myself and Amy and Reg and Blake was coming and going, but it was honestly like the Big Brother house. You know, I was lounging around the house, water's leaking for the week, in and out of hospital. These guys just sort of staring at me, being like, are you in labor yet? Are you in labor yet?
And every night, myself and Reggie go to bed and be like, wonder if we're going to get our baby tomorrow.
Each morning, we'd be like, hi, Katie, so what's going on?
Any sign of that baby coming in case I'm trying to keep it in? And we're like, okay.
Oh man,
it was just a really, and you know, if I had been like, oh, you know, I've got a headache, not feeling well, they would have kind of jumped to see what was going on. And
yeah,
we did it like, it was a slow week. It was definitely a slow week.
Yeah.
And my kids were with the in-laws and then they stayed with the in-laws.
That was okay, was it? Yeah.
So we did drive to meet them halfway between where they were, and they were at the beach having a great time.
Yeah.
And I got to see them and stuff. But it was pretty mentally challenging. It was like preparing for a marathon, you know, like I was just every day waiting to see what's happening, you know, and it was hard being away from my family too.
Yeah,
like I ended up being away from them for about 11 days or something. I'd never been away from my kids for that long.
Yeah.
And then they decided they were going to induce me at 37 weeks.
Right.
Which isn't that much fun.
No, inductions. I've been down that road, as I was telling you before we started. Yeah. So yeah, it's...
So they had this new oral induction where they give you a tablet in the hospital and they're like, we haven't had anyone fail with it yet. Fail, which is a word I hate. We haven't had anyone not progress with this. So they did that and we were in the hospital and I was walking the corridors and I was every hour taking my oral thing. We had two midwives of our own there and we had the room dark and...
Amy and Reggie were still
Amy
excited.
And Reggie's
watching.
Waiting for their baby to just fly into their arms.
So Amy and Reggie were there and was Blake there too?
Yeah, so the hospital and birthing system in New Zealand is very different because, as Amy mentioned earlier, the idea of the whānau in New Zealand and your family is so different. So when you're giving birth, you can have anybody you want.
Yeah,
so
most people, as many as you want.
And as many as you want. So most people will give birth with their mums there.
Yeah.
My first birth, I had one of my best friends in the room and... That support is amazing. Yeah. And even actually when my daughter was born in Hotla Street and I wrote to the hospital and requested that my older sister could be there because I think that support is for your husband, partner and yourself is just wonderful.
It's a lot of pressure, I think, on a partner to be everything for you in that situation.
And for possibly 2 days or more, you know, like, and not fed and watered. And
Like I remember about 36 hours into my epidural with Sam or into my induction with Sam, I got an epidural and it was like the best moment of my whole life.
Yeah.
And I fell asleep then.
Yeah.
But Gordon didn't.
No.
Like he didn't sleep.
And he'd been
for
awake
that
for
entire
days.
Yeah, exactly.
So we were really, really lucky in that respect because that's one of the things when you're going through all the counselling and what needs to be addressed in other countries with legislation is who's in the room, who can be in the room, and how does everybody feel about that?
Yeah.
And we had also discussed that if I was to have a C-section, that it would be Amy who came into the room, because only one person would be allowed in the C-section, which is fair. So that would be me and Amy. So that first day,
of everybody's watching me, waiting for me to go into labor. I mean, like, no wonder I didn't go into labor with an induction. There were so many people watching and waiting for this baby.
Oh my God,
though,
like, I can't see, like, having been there and having done the 2-day induction and all the rest, like, it's hard enough when you're on your own. Like, I can't even imagine with the expectation, no offense, Amy, but the expectation of other people, like, oh my God, that must have been so hard.
And it was, do you know what? I got to the end of that day and I had had mild labour pains and that was it. And then they were like, okay, we'll just start you straight away on the oxytocin and try another form. And my midwife was like, no way. She is going to bed and you were giving her a sleeping tablet and she's going to sleep. Mm. Thank God she said that.
Amazing, yeah.
But I went to bed that night already feeling really broken.
Yeah.
You know, already feeling like I've had a week of this anticipation. Now I've had a failed induction. I am absolutely exhausted. And like, you know, we talked about my dad. I remember just lying in the bed talking to dad, being like, I need to get through this, dad.
Yeah.
How am I going to do it? You know, sorry, I'm getting emotional now.
That's okay.
Because that was like a really, really low moment, you know. Yeah. I really wanted to do this. And it was all leading up to this pain, moment, yeah. You know. And I was there in the hospital and it's not what we had planned.
Yeah.
So,
and that this is not what we planned moment, I think a lot of parents can relate
totally,
to, I'm sure.
Totally,
because
you know?
You do, there's so much expectation, but for you, it's so layered. Like, I'm not surprised
so layered,
at all.
And that was what it was, you know? And you know, really, like, how can you expect someone to get oxytocin up and give birth to someone else's baby that you're trying not to connect to, you know? And we had talked about whether an elective C-section would have been the right thing, and we couldn't get it. Where I live in New Zealand, there isn't that private care, so that wasn't an option. It took me a long time to get seen by an obstetrician in where I lived in New Zealand. So then they're like, okay, we'll get you up at 7 a.m., you know, and they came in with my piece of toast and my tea, and I was like, is that all you're going to give me before I have to go through a day of labor?
Exactly, like come on.
And then so these
Where's
guys
the
like, yeah, totally, come on, like it's like a marathon. So I had to ring Amy and Reggie and Blake and be like, look, they're bringing me down at 7 a.m. and I'm up and I'm at them already, and I was really like pulling the energy from non-existent places. So then I was straight onto the oxytocin. And that started to ramp up, I'd say, by the middle of the day, that started to ramp up. And then there was a stage where I felt like, this is active labor. Mm. You know, I was giving it my all. And I was really felt like I was progressing, so much so that my midwife was, you know, they were sort of under there trying, ready to catch a baby. And Amy and Reggie were ready to receive their baby.
Yeah.
And the room was dark and we were all at it. And then all of a sudden I was like, I can't feel this baby. I'm in hard labor and I cannot feel that, you know, I'd given birth twice before.
Yeah.
And my midwife was like, okay, well, we'll call them in to have a look and check. I was, so what was I, a day and a half into labours at this stage? I was 3 centimetres dilated.
Ugh, gutting.
Like, gutting. Like, I couldn't cope. And then I lost control. You know that moment in labour when things just become too hard?
Yeah.
And I lost control. So then...
Yeah, that's the, I can't do this.
I can't do this. I'm out. Someone has to do this for me at this
there.
Point.
Yeah.
So I had, then it was straight away called for the epidural. And then the decision was made for a C-section. But within that period of time, Florence's heart decelerated.
Mm.
So she kind of made the decision herself at that point. Mm. And then it was into an emergency C-section.
Yeah.
So it was gear Amy up, get her into the room with me, and off we went.
So how were you at this stage, Amy?
So we obviously the week of waiting when we're all excited was kind of like when we're getting a baby. But the moment we went into the hospital for the start of the inductions, like watching your sister, first of all, giving birth to her own baby it is a huge thing, but giving birth to our baby and not being able to do anything. So I do feel like Katie had three husbands in the room in a sense, or three partners, because none of us could really do anything. And she's doing all the work and you're like, oh my God, like, whoa, that's bonkers what you're doing. Like, the, as in, like, birth is bonkers.
Yeah,
like,
it is, yeah.
Everything,
and
watching
you can't
it all
prepare
happen.
Anything. Like, our midwife was trying to prepare Amy and Reggie and going through all the different scenarios. But I actually just don't think, until you've done it, you can't.
Yeah. But I think also until you see what birth is. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, seeing someone trying to give birth, it, like, there's no way of describing it. Like, you can watch videos and you can Google things and stuff. But actually, like, seeing her going through that experience
the two of us were like, whoa, this is crazy.
Yeah.
And also, like, you can't do anything. You know your baby's in there and you're hoping your baby comes out safely. And, you know, like...
Yeah, you've got that worry as well.
But watching it, you can see why, like, as we watched her in labor, you're like, okay, now I see that, you know, again, the giving birth, you do take for granted, as in, like, it's a risky business.
You can
see that, like... Things can go wrong and
life can be lost.
Yeah. And yeah. How much of a relief it is when a baby is born, you know? So yeah, we were just kind of like at that stage, kind of like, she needs to get that baby out. Like,
cause yeah,
I knew that
she was
just, you know, had done more than she could, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah. Like going into the C-section as well.
It was a relief.
Yeah.
You know, like as you say, when you get the epidural in this best moment of your life, having the epidural in, which took a long time to get the epidural in, took quite a few goes. Having the epidural in, being wheeled into that theatre, then Amy and I began to joke and laugh because we just...
You knew it, like, was going to be over soon.
There was a timeline on it. The baby was going to... We didn't know we were having a girl at the time. The baby was going to be there and that was, you know...
And even though it's a major abdominal surgery, it's a relief. You're like, great, cut this baby out.
Yeah, especially after the 2 days. I was the same. I had an emergency section on Ted and I was the same. Like, it wasn't what I wanted. It wasn't what I planned for, but I needed it to be over.
Totally.
And I totally get that. So then, I mean, it happened and Amy, you had your baby and Katie... You got to give Amy her baby.
And that's the highlight. Like, that's what, when you're going through the pregnancy and stuff, you dream about. And that emotion was what I wanted it to be and what I expected it to be, you know. And we had these kind of funny conversations about, like, simple things you don't think about. When the baby's born, who are they going to give the baby to?
Yeah.
You know, and there was a talk that maybe the baby should be going to me so I could deliver my placenta if I had a vaginal delivery. But I just couldn't cope with that. I was like, the baby needs to go straight to Amy. It's not my baby.
Yeah.
And Amy needs to do all that stuff. And I just need to be cared for by Blake and the doctors in a different way.
Yeah.
And I have to say, the hospital were very good at that.
They were amazing. Like, everyone who we dealt with knew what we were doing. So they knew that it wasn't Katie's baby or genetically linked to her. And they were really supportive on making sure that when Florence was born, it was fully my job. And I think that's a really important part of the surrogacy journey, is that...
For both of you, I would think.
Totally. Yeah.
You're talking about, like, attachment is profound, you know. It's an intense, and it needs to be managed carefully so that you, Katie, could emotionally, you know, manage this situation, and Amy, so that you would get that super important, valuable time with your new baby.
And like, there is that side, but there's also the really important part on, like, the admin of a surrogacy, that the moment the baby's born, it's my choice to make medical decisions, and that is all a part that has to be, you know, like, it falls to that, to the parents then, like the intended parents being myself and Reggie, that actually anything, if any medical decisions have to be made, that it falls to you, because there is that kind of gray area that sometimes it can, like, the surrogate can be asked and it's like, well, it's not mine to make a decision.
Yeah.
So she was fully then in our care, and it was just like...
They gave Amy and Reggie a room and they gave me a room. So I was never in a room with another baby.
Okay.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, I think having to lie in bed at night after a C-section, not have a baby, would have been very hard. But I was like relieved and in my own room and put my feet up and watching TV. Yeah. You know, and
moving on. Starting to move on. Yeah.
Starting to move on. And, you know, people say, like, is it hard handing over a baby? Florence is never my baby.
Mm.
I was just a means of her coming into the world, you know, and I wasn't attached from her, but I wasn't attached to her either. You know, I knew she was Amy and Reggie's baby.
And that, like, it was amazing in the hospital, because we were like a few rooms down from Katie, and I got my own room with a bed, because you also, the practicalities of, like, when you're a surrogate mum, sometimes don't have a bed and your baby's in a basket and you've nowhere to be to change your baby or whatever. Like, there's all those things that hospitals, again, in the legislation in Ireland, have to be aware of and plan for. Like, if a baby's born, like, I know other parents who have not had anywhere to sleep, and their baby's in the hospital and they've been sleeping on chairs, like, they are born outside. So there is all those things. And
I would have not like to have been recovering from a C-section, having their baby in the room and them asleep on the chair in the room. Like,
no.
You know, that...
But, yeah.
So those sort of things are huge.
They have to be factored in, yeah.
And they've got to be factored in everybody's mental health post,
you know,
and in are all recovering.
And so how was it for you, Amy? I mean, like, becoming a mother is always, in my opinion, shocking. It's always like, oh, wow, okay, no, this is really...
This is it.
This is I'm giving my life entirely over to this little thing. Yeah. You know, at the beginning, that's what it's like.
And there's no going back.
And there's no going back. That's my friend described it as walking into a room and having a door closed behind you, and you can literally never walk back through it. Yeah. Everything is changed.
No, and I get that. Like, and it does change. And it's been the most incredible change in our lives. Like, it's bonkers, but it's so magic. And like when Florence was born, I just gained skin with her, and I had also induced my lactation so I could breastfeed her.
This is one of the most amazing things I have ever heard of. When I heard you were doing this, I was like, honestly, I wanted to drive to your house. I didn't know where you lived, and give you some sort of medal, because
it was huge.
It was a huge task, and I'm so glad I did it.
Like, I think a lot of people won't be aware that this is a possibility. So can you just explain, just in very like layman's terms? Right.
Yeah. So when we were in New Zealand, obviously, neither of us were working, we were just helping Katie's family, and I needed a bit of a project, and it had been something that Reggie had actually said at one stage he'd like me to try and breastfeed the baby because it would be good for a bond. And I was like, oh, okay, well, so I obviously had to check out my oncologist to make sure it was okay to, you know, change, you're kind of, you are messing with your hormones and stuff. Yeah. Anyways, it was fine. So I did a lot of Googling, and I read like how to do it. So basically, it was actually an anti-nausea tablet that went wrong, and people's milk came in, and even men's milk came in, apparently.
Wow.
So now it's used to induce lactation. So you take this tablet daily, and you pump, and you pump. And I pumped for 3 months before she was born, every 3 hours through the day.
The dedication.
To bring my milk in.
I pumped after Sam was born for a few months, and it was hellish. It's such a commitment. I'm glad, I have no regrets. Like, I'm glad I did it, but like, it's such a commitment, Amy. That is incredible. Did it make you feel kind of connected to her in a way ahead of time, or did you feel connected anyway?
I think, like, on a surrogacy journey, like, you have no other comparison. I never was pregnant, so I never experienced pregnancy and a pregnancy loss. So, like, my journey is so different. So, like, I always felt connected to whatever this pregnancy was. Now, like, I never, like, the pregnancy for me was never a pregnancy that, like, I spent time rubbing Katie's tummy or anything. Yeah. That wasn't part of our pregnancy journey.
Yeah.
But, it was something that I was happy to do. And then now on reflection, I'm so glad I did it, because then when she was born, I straight away fed her, which was, I guess it took kind of straight away put me into a role of that I was doing part of the normal, in a sense, way of what kind of, now could I do it again? Probably not.
Yeah.
But I'm really glad I did it.
Yeah.
And it was a huge undertaking.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because absolutely.
I think it's hard for your milk to ever properly come in without actually carrying a child. Mm. So your milk supply is lower than normal. So there's the other, like, supplementing of milk that I'd pumped before she was born and stuff. So, but it was, I think it was really important that I did it.
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then it took the pressure off me too. New Zealand is very kind of pro-breastfeeding, very supportive of breastfeeding. And so there was kind of like the question of, would I pump for the baby? And I actually know other surrogates who have breastfed their baby. But that was a bit too much for me.
Yeah.
But I have breastfed all my own kids, but I wasn't really... that wasn't really on the cards for me. So I was then able to just kind of happily take the medication to stop my milk.
And you didn't feel like anybody was losing out.
No, nobody was losing out. And there was no expectation. There was no kind of underlying, oh, should you be giving her some milk? So I was able to just get on with my life then from there on out.
And we could kind of, like, our midwife as well was amazing, kind of support when trying to prepare us for someone you can't prepare us for. And then helping me, like, I obviously went to a few lactation consultants as well. But also
Florence ended up in NICU for a week with jaundice. But like, I met a girl in there who gave me some of her milk. And then my midwife also got other milk from other women in the community. I had too much milk. So I was really happy for her to have as much milk as she could have, especially when she was so jaundiced. So it is really, it's a totally different feeding experience in New Zealand, as opposed to, I suppose, if actually Florence had been born here, it might have been, I might have breastfed her.
Yeah.
So that, like, it's just interesting, the different cultures of and the support, like, there's so much support for breastfeeding in New Zealand. I just don't, from my friends' pregnancy journeys, I don't feel like the support has been here.
Yeah,
really.
I think there's, I don't think anyone would deny that there's work that needs to be done. I mean, I think even, like, people who work within the system would agree that there's work that needs to be done there.
Yeah.
So what was it like from then on then?
Great.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, like, I remember Blake being sort of like, oh, my main job will be to support you postnatally. And, you know, there was kind of this question of how would my mental health be postnatally?
Yeah.
But because I had, I think, struggled a little bit during the pregnancy, I was wonderful afterwards. Like, I totally wasn't expecting that. But there was so much joy in what we had done. My kids were getting so much joy out of it. Amy and Reggie were so happy. Everybody around the world was so happy for us.
Yeah.
That it was actually lovely, you know, and I had no blues or tough time. I had no tough times. The toughest time was dropping them to the airport and saying goodbye, you know.
Yeah. How long were you in New Zealand in the end? It was a good while, wasn't it?
So we were 6 months in New Zealand. So we flew back when Florence was 6 weeks old.
Six weeks. And they needed to get back to their own lives, you know, because it had been such a unplanned 6 months.
And how did it feel to say goodbye?
It was devastating for us. It was just devastating not knowing when we were going to see them again, because I guess when we were starting the journey, we thought, okay, we'll leave and then we'll see Katie and her family, in a few months' time. But COVID was just so wild at the time that we knew it was going to be a long time.
Yeah, because I'm home now for the first time in 3 years.
Yeah,
so I, like, Florence will be 2 in July.
Yeah.
And I'm only just seeing her for the second time now since she was 6 weeks.
And what's your relationship with her like?
We obviously get lots of photos and videos of her every day.
Yeah.
But I was talking to my own counsellor about it before I came here, and she was saying, I'm so pleased to hear you're excited to see Florence, because I was worried that you were quite attached from her. But I think the detachment was part of the protection, you know, like, I hadn't been trying to think about it too much. And then I got excited about it, but when I knew we were finally able to come home. And now being here with her is awesome, you know, and she's such a character.
Is she? And I bet, what's your kids' take on this whole thing?
And my kids are great. They're really good. And it's so funny, like, they were obviously so young that sex education wasn't on their radar yet. So, you know, when we told them we were pregnant with our third, so that was like only a few months after Florence.
Your poor body.
My poor body. Whoops. They asked me who we're going to give the baby to.
Right.
You know, they don't grasp it. They didn't grasp it at all. And they have these lovely books about, like, kangaroos who carry other babies in their pouch. And they know so much about the fact that some people have 2 dads, some people have 2 moms, some people have different types of families. And, you know, and then Cooper had to do a show and tell in school and he had to bring in a memory. So we brought in the circusy book to tell his friends about.
Yeah.
And, you know, he tried really hard. Like, he told his friends that Amy couldn't have a baby because she didn't have a placenta. But he was pretty close, right? He was pretty close.
Close enough. For a 6-year-old.
Yeah, for a 6-year-old, he kind of gets it. So they understand and they talk about it. And then, like, Florence says to Amy that her belly button is Katie's belly button.
Mm.
You know, so, like, we have all those. It's part of their story.
I think in a way, like, what a beautiful thing, not in a way, just flat out, what a beautiful thing to show your kids that families happen in so many different ways.
I, like, 100% agree.
And, you know, kids that age are so open-minded. Like, when you hear some of the hysteria around conversations that shouldn't happen in front of children, and children shouldn't be aware of, say, people's different sexualities or whatever, it's wild. It's like, no, they are so wide open, you know, that the more they soak in of the variety of life and the diversity of people,
totally,
the better.
Yeah, absolutely. And we just don't want it to be a secret for them, or
Really, since, like, Florence was on the way, they were really kind of, we explained to them all the time, and they knew the whole time that
it wasn't going to be their brother or sister.
And then when they met her, they were just like, they were 2 and 4, but they were just so
pleased
and, you know, like, the relationship is really strong, even though it's been really at a real distance.
Yeah. But they're actually really, like, one of the books talks about being proud of being able to help somebody else make a family.
Yeah.
And they're proud that they were able to help Amy and Reggie make a family. Like, that's lovely.
So beautiful.
It you know, like, it is lovely. Yeah.
Well, I like the reason I know the reason that you guys wanted to do this, and I'm so grateful that you did.
Yeah.
Is that there are some important conversations about surrogacy happening in Ireland right now.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm interested to know what are the main things that you want people to know in the context of these conversations.
It's a big question, Louise.
I know. I know.
Well, I suppose, like, it's a surrogacy journey is so complicated. And when you get your baby, you finally have the part of your family that you needed
and that you wanted so hard for.
Yeah, and everyone is, like, everyone has helped, no matter who, if your surrogate is your sibling or is someone who you've created a relationship to carry your baby. And, you know, Florence was born, everyone was so excited and nearly overwhelmingly as well here, like, with family and with friends and stuff. And, you know, when we got home, I flew back from New Zealand, and we were quite anxious flying back from New Zealand because I was flying with legally my brother-in-law and my sister's child. So when Florence was born, she's genetically mine and my husband's, but she's not recognized in Ireland as myself and Reggie's child. She's recognized as Katie and Blake's.
And because I'm Irish, she was entitled to an Irish passport. So that takes, like, some families that never really get that Irish passport.
Yeah.
We're really lucky that I'm Amy's sister and that I'm Irish, that she was able to get a passport. But she actually flew home on a New Zealand passport.
She flew home on a Kiwi passport. And, you know, us both travelling back with Irish passports and Florence travelling back with a Kiwi one. Questions can be asked.
Now, yeah, what's going to happen in the airport?
What's going to happen in the airport? And in New Zealand, again, their culture being very like inclusive family-wise. You can put whatever birth name you want on the birth cert. So I recognise myself as my married name as a white, but I haven't changed legally because in New Zealand, when Florence was born, we were able to call her Hamilton White, even though White is from my husband and not from Katie's husband, even though she's legally their child. So we were able to fly home with our child with both of our names on it.
Okay,
but
great.
Actually, she's not legally my child. So in a sense, I shouldn't have been flying with her. So we had to go and we left to fly home, we had to get a lot of documents written up and signed and stamped to say it was okay that Katie and Blake had given permission for me and Reggie to fly home with our genetic child. Which is one hurdle. But then I suppose when we arrive home, you know, it's just complicated. Like, I wanted to try and set up Florence's PPS number. She's an Irish citizen. But Katie had to apply for it from New Zealand to try and get it set up. And again, then with her child allowance and her medical card and all of those things. Now, amazingly, Katie's my sister, so it's easier for her to want to do it for her niece. But if it was a different relationship with someone who you created a surrogacy relationship with, you don't really want to be going back to them and being like, do you mind contacting
see
about a PPS number for...
It's also just fundamentally wrong. Like, it's just wrong. I mean, I think anybody who has listened to you guys talk about this situation can acknowledge that it's wrong that the parents of this child should not be recognised as the parents of this child. And I know that there are hundreds of other people in Ireland who have had children via surrogacy who are in the same boat.
So, yeah, like, there is, and I suppose as we have a surrogate child now, I'm learning more and more people, and the amazing WhatsApp group that I'm in, I see how many people who are trying to go on this journey. And when you have your baby, you just want to then become parents, and it's such a new road becoming parents, no matter what.
It's hard enough.
You're so busy with all of the other things, and you're trying to learn this new role, but you also have to then work out all the legal logistics. So, like, we're still now in the stage of going to the courts to get Reggie, through DNA tests, recognised as her legal father. But Katie, unfortunately, is going to be recognised as her legal mother. Like, I can apply to be her guardian.
But never her mother.
But what never her legal mother at the moment. So, like, things like, if when she's two now, I can apply to be her guardian. But I'm only her guardian up to age 18, which is going to fly. And nearly, you know, when she's 18, you are an adult, but you're not, you know. And then, like, things like inheritance. inheritance wise, she's not treated the same as if she was legally my child, and all the different things like applying for schools and stuff. And
but everything even aside is more complicated. From, even aside from the logistics, like the logistics are obviously extremely, yeah. like that's annoying and frustrating and a complication. But it's also, I mean, emotionally.
Yeah, I suppose because we have her, I try not to get too annoyed about it because she's such a wonderful distraction. But it's unfair. It's expensive.
Yeah.
It's really expensive. It's like going to court and stuff. Like, you don't want to go to court unless you really have to. And we have to try and sort out legal relationships with her. But and even if genetically she wasn't related to me and I had, you know, used donor or whatever, there still needs to be a framework there because, like, if anything did happen to Reggie, I don't have any legal entitlement to my daughter. Like, it's easier to sort it out for him because the kind of traditional way the law is written. So I just hope that it comes soon because these babies that are born through surrogacy, everyone has played such a big part in it, and it's been so complicated and so emotional, and forever will be an emotional journey. But for me not to be recognized as my mother, and I just think like women in Ireland have so much of a battle ahead of them in many senses, but when you are doing the role of a mother and you're actually not legally her mother, even though you should be legally her mother, it's just a lot. Like,
I'm annoyed, so I can only imagine what it's got to be like for you. And even for you, Katie, I bet it's frustrating because you're not her mother and you've never been her mother and you clearly have never considered yourself
her mother. I mean, she's not, but
it's cut and dry.
Again, we're lucky that we're sisters.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I actually feel really strongly about them legislating surrogacy in Ireland for other reasons as well as the legal side of it. Like, people say to me all the time, oh, you know, we couldn't have surrogacy because women would get taken advantage of, and commercial surrogacy and people getting paid to have babies. That needs to be dealt with. If we don't legislate it, more women are at risk of being taken advantage of.
Yeah.
So the way the system works in New Zealand, I was prepared for everything. And it was a very hard journey, but I had all the supports in place because of the ethics, because of the counselling, because of all that.
The infrastructure.
If you don't have that, and if we didn't go through it through New Zealand, like had we just randomly flown to Spain and got it inserted, maybe I wouldn't have been as well off.
Yeah.
But because there was structure and legislation, I was able for it.
Yeah.
And that's what actually worries me more, is not by not having surrogacy legislated, we're letting down women who want to and might become surrogates. Instead, you know, they need to be supported.
They need the protection.
And they need the structure. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that your story is very powerful, and I think it really illustrates a lot of the issues that are, you know, in the system at the moment, but also just kind of the humanity of all of this. You know, we need to, this has to be dealt with, I think, as a matter of urgency.
Totally. Like, fertility issues aren't improving, you know. It seems like more and more people need help. More people are starting their families late. More people have medical issues. So more and more people are going to be looking to go on this journey.
Yeah. And I feel for same-sex couples that are both male.
Yeah.
Like, if they, you know, if adoption isn't the option for them, this is the option. And we have welcomed that in our society, that we are divided, that same-sex couples can get married. So, like, what is our structure for them to have children?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Like, I know that there is North America that supports it. And then there was the Ukraine. Like, we were on a sibling journey in the Ukraine early at the end of last year. And we had done a transfer a few weeks before the war, which had failed. And 2 days before the war started, we paused on the second transfer. So now we're kind of, you know, having to look at what options we have for a sibling. But it's just really hard that you have to go away.
Yeah.
Like, you can't do it in Ireland. And I suppose, like, from the things that uproot things is, if we do end up having a child in a different country, we have to go and we can't work, you know?
I think we just, as a country, we have to stop exporting things that are too complicated or too difficult to deal with.
And like, so many other countries.
Surely we have to learn that at some stage.
Yeah. And when you can put a structure in other countries and set it up like there's definitely something that can be done. I know it's a huge piece of work, but there's hundreds of babies in this country that we don't even know how many are there because they're not documented. Because like when I filled out the census, I was just like, oh, there is a, do I put her as my child? She's not my child. And, you know, like there's no space for it. So we haven't documented them because there's no way to document them.
But
so
that's, they're even, all undercover. Even that kills me that you had that moment filling out the census when she is your child. And all of us sitting here, we know she's your child. But because of the legality, there's that question mark that you still have to consider. And that's wrong.
I mean, it's just wrong. Capsule.
The little box.
Good. I read it in the time capsule. Good. I tried to explain it because I was like, I'm putting her down as my child, but she's technically not my child. She is my child, but I don't know where to go. And I know that there's hundreds of us out there, and hopefully there'll be more because it is an option for certain people, and it is the only option. And you don't want it to be so complicated that people either give up or have one child and then can't have a sibling if they want a sibling, you know?
And also it can't be something that is only afforded to wealthy people or to people who can manage to, I'm not suggesting that you're, you know, billionaires, but people who can manage
to be able
pull
to do
the
it.
Money together. Yeah. Like, I mean, it's not fair to have two tiers.
And if we have those two tiers, then we end up having women taken advantage of.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Katie and Amy, thank you so much for choosing to talk to me about this. I so appreciate it. I think it's such a valuable experience to share. Like, my whole thing is that, like, you know, a shared experience is the most powerful thing we have, but especially in the context, as you know, as you guys know, of the current discussion about legislation.
Yeah.
I'm so happy for you. I really wish you all the best. I'm so sorry that your sibling plans kind of were derailed by what's happening in Ukraine. I hope that there's another path and that you get there. And I'm so happy that you have your lovely Florence. And I hope you have a great time together here
in
Ireland.
Yeah, it's we are. Special, yeah, so thanks.
Thank you. Crazy.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.